From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He soared onto the national stage and then fell on his face. He was the self-described champion of the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. But his howl heard round the world in Iowa sounded more like the swan song of any progressive takeover of a party which quickly turned to safe bet John Kerry. Conventional wisdom and Kerry both got whipped in the election, and now the Democrats' power players are faced once again with the prospect of a Dean revolution, worried once again about alienating the middle. He's fiery, provocative, and blunt, and now he is chair of the Democratic National Committee. Tonight on Point, the return of Howard Dean and what it means for the Democratic Party. We begin tonight in Washington. Howard Fineman is chief political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. I asked him what range of responses he's hearing from Democrats to Howard Dean's return.
Everywhere from ecstasy to despair, as you might expect. But I think overall, Democrats are, for the most part, trying to look on the bright side as they usher in the Dean era.
Who's happy? Who's not?
I think grassroots activists are happy. I think people outside the Beltway, to a large extent, are happy. I think people who supported Dean when he was trying to get the Democratic nomination are ecstatic. And I think there's a general fighting mood among Democrats that probably helps Dean here.
And those who are disappointed with his taking the DNC chairmanship?
Well, I think a lot of members of Congress are very wary. They know that Howard Dean ran as an outsider for the nomination. They know he said he represented the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, which meant to them that he was trying to write them out of it. They couldn't get together, the insiders, on an alternative to Dean, which is one reason why he won. I think some of them are concerned that his penchant for making fiery pronouncements, while exciting, could get the party in trouble. And they know that on social issues, especially, Dean has said some things that will be bulletin board material for the conservatives, and that his view on the war in Iraq, while shared by many activist Democrats, indeed by the majority of the country, I think maybe right now, doesn't help the Democrats even so make headway in the red states.
What is Howard Dean's role supposed to be as DNC chair?
It's supposed to have right now is Mr. Nuts and Bolts, Mr. Net and Blog, the guy who's going to use the energy of the Internet and the bloggers and the state parties and the local officials to really energize the base and get the vote out next time around, as the Democrats did in some places but didn't do in enough places. That's the theory of it.
Does Dean appear ready to play that role? He's been very high profile, of course, as a presidential candidate. This is a more backroom role, or has been.
It has been. In his press conference after being named chairman on Saturday, he said that for the most part, the policy pronouncing would be left to others, would be left to members of Congress, to governors, to others. But, of course, the key words were, for the most part, to expect Howard Dean to keep his mouth shut is, you know, to expect the sun not to come up in the morning.
When you really dig into it, what is it, Howard Fineman, that Dean's backers want from him? What do they hope from him? What do they hope he'll bring?
I think they hope he'll bring the kind of energy and excitement and sort of rock star enthusiasm that he generated when he first began running for the nomination. I mean, if you can remember back to the summer and fall of 2003, there was just tremendous excitement as much about the way Dean was rising as for who Howard Dean was. I mean, I think a lot of people had no idea who he was. He was a governor of Vermont from a small state with a penchant for making quotable, sometimes too quotable statements. But it was the way he did it. It was the fact that he wasn't funded by big donors, that he wasn't a creature of the fat cats and the soft money people, that he seemed to be a grassroots guy, that he was using the Internet as an organizing device and as a messaging device. I think that was enormously exciting to people because it seemed like a genuine expression of democracy, and it was as though Howard Dean was kind of uncorking a new force in politics. And that excitement, if he can duplicate it, will be crucial to the Democrats next time around.
And what about his opponents? We're reading that, you know, from congressional leaders to the Democratic governors to the Clintons, top Democrats all terrified of a Dean victory. Why?
They're afraid that he was too liberal on social issues, that he was too out front in his criticism of the war. And if you look at the exit polls, you can see that one problem that the Democrats had is that too many swing voters felt that Democrats just as a group were a little too unwilling to contemplate the use of force. and post 9/11, even though diplomacy is required, force can and sometimes is required. Now, did George Bush overdo it in Iraq? A lot of people think so, but I don't think, on the other hand, people want to be led by a party or by a president that thinks talk is all that's necessary, and that kind of cultural divide between guns and talk, if you will, as oversimplified a division of that is something that people worry about with respect to Dean. That and his liberalism on social issues. What a lot of people don't know is what Dean wants to tell everybody, which is that as governor of Vermont, he was really a pinch penny, a real tightwad, and a guy who cared about balancing budgets. But it hasn't been shown in American politics in the last 50 or 75 years that running on a campaign to balance the budget is going to get you anywhere.
He said on Saturday that if you'd told me a year ago I'd be standing here doing this as your choice for chairman, I would not have believed you, and neither would a lot of other people. How did he do it? There were some big names talked about here. Gebhardt, Daschle, Wesley Clark, Nancy Pelosi was behind, Tim Romer, the former Indiana Democratic representative. How did Howard Dean pull this off?
Same way he got going last time around, which is by shoe leather, by traveling around the country, by meeting people face-to-face, by out-organizing them on the ground and on the net, and by being out there when others weren't. A lot of those other names you mentioned, they're kind of interested in it, but they would tolerate it, but wanted to be coronated. You know, Howard Dean's not that kind of guy. He's going to go out there and grab the crown through hard work, and that's what he did. He simply out-organized everybody, and the other people who feared him couldn't settle on an alternative. Some Hill people wanted Congressman Tim Romer. Some Hill people wanted Congressman Marty Frost. You mentioned some other names. And the Clintons were of two minds. They feared Dean because of his liberal reputation, but they couldn't find anybody to bear the standard for the Clintons, which is what essentially Terry McAuliffe, the outgoing chairman, had been doing for 8 years.
So if the Washington Center Democratic leadership couldn't derail the Dean nomination, then who's really got the Democratic Party's bit in its teeth now? Who's driving this party?
Nobody. I would say it's a runaway stagecoach, except it's not running anywhere real fast. It's just sort of wandering around in the corral because they don't have any leadership right now, and they don't really know where they want to go other than to oppose just about everything George Bush is proposing or stands for. That'll get them a far distance. I mean, you know, as John Kerry pointed out, you know, a 60,000 vote difference in Ohio, and he would have squeaked through in the Electoral College. But I do think the Democrats have to have a lot of serious thinking and arguing to do among themselves. But Howard Dean can't be in that role, because if he ends up fighting with other Democrats about the direction of the party, then he won't do them any good.
James Carville, of course, famously saying, this is pathetic. He said, this is supposed to be a rigged deal, not something that shoe leather wins, but that bosses win in smoke-filled rooms.
Well, as usual, Carville has it, you know, right on. But it's just a measure of the problem that the party has. And I think they need to make a virtue of it and just have at it. They need to argue about things all over again. Don't forget the Republicans. When the Republicans were out of power, when the Democrats were at their zenith, going way back to the 60s, the Republicans really had vicious, vicious battles that lasted 10, 15, 20 years between the old moderate wing and the conservative wing. Conservatives took over progressively through Reagan, and they're sort of reaching their apogee with Bush here. Democrats probably have to go through the same cycle, and they probably may as well have at it, because it's only through a debate about ideas that they're really going to revive themselves.
So is Dean, the Democrats, Barry Goldwater, is he bringing that old-time religion, a touch of the relic here? Is he the one that takes them way back to progressive principles and starts a long march to, return?
Well, if he wanted to do that, I don't think being party chairman is the way to do it. I think he needed to stay on the outside, but he decided to grasp for this. It's a very interesting move on his part. We'll see what he can do. I mean, he's a smart guy. He knows how to start fights. I don't think that's what the Democratic Party chairman has been in the past, but maybe if he decides to hold some discussions and sponsor some debates about things, the people on the Hill will grit their teeth, but maybe it'll be to the good. That's the positive side. The flip side is that he ends up getting in fights with everybody around Washington and quits in a huff just in time to run for president again himself in 2007.
He can be a gritty, punchy guy.
I'm willing to take long odds that he's not going to be party chairman all the way through the 2008 election.
Wow, there's a picture. Howard Fineman, thanks very much for filling us in.
Okay.
Howard Fineman, chief political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from Washington. We're talking tonight about the return of Howard Dean, now as chair of the Democratic National Committee. Are you celebrating Dr. Dean's victory? And if you are you a Democrat or a Republican? What does Howard Dean stand for to you and to the country? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined right now from Hanover, New Hampshire, by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack Beatty, are you celebrating? What do you make of this chairmanship?
Well, you know, in retrospect, I understand how he did it, because let's recall it was at this meeting of the DNC winter meeting 2 years ago that Howard Dean gave really one of the strongest speeches in recent years for the Democratic Party. He began by saying, "What I want to know is why in the world the Democratic Party leadership is supporting the president's unilateral attack on Iraq." Cheers, applause. "What I want to know is why are Democratic Party leaders supporting tax cuts? What I want to know is why we're fighting in Congress about the patient's bill of rights when the Democratic Party ought to be standing up for health care for every American. What I want to know is why our folks are voting for the president's No Child Left Behind bill that leaves every child behind. I'm Howard Dean, and I'm here to represent the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party." That was to this very audience, practically.
Yeah.
And these folks went wild about that. And that speech made Howard Dean. And
but will he make the party a winner, Jack?
Well, that's a long question. And, you know, he says he wants to go down to the red states and campaign. But, you know, he made a singularly inept remark about the red states and Confederate flags in the campaign, showing an insensitivity, as many Southerners told us, to all that's involved in that issue. I don't know.
Jack, hold the thought. We'll go down that long trail of the answer to that question. We're talking tonight about the return of Howard Dean. Jack Beatty's with us. More to come. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support.
This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the return of Howard Dean as chair of the Democratic National Committee and what it means for the Democratic Party. You can join the conversation tonight. Is Dr. Dean just what the Democrats need, or is he a big mistake? What does Howard Dean stand for to you, to the country? And are the Democrats moving here to revive with Dr. Dean or to self-destruct? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In his acceptance speech on Saturday, Howard Dean pointed out that the Democrats are not the first party to lose their way.
Republicans wandered around in the political wilderness for 40 years before they took back Congress. But the reason that we lost control is because we forgot why we were entrusted with that control in the first place. The American people cannot afford to wait for 40 more years for us to put Washington back to work for them. It cannot take us that long. And it won't take us that long, not if we stand up for what we believe in, organize at the local level, and recognize that this party strength does not come from the consultants down. It comes from the grassroots up.
Howard Dean accepting the chair of the Democratic National Committee on Saturday in Washington. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty is with us tonight. We're joined now from New York by Katrina Vandenhovel. She's editor of The Nation magazine, co-editor of Taking Back America and Taking Down the Radical Right. Katrina Vandenhovel, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And from New York, Dan Gerstein joins us. He's Democratic communications strategist. He's been a senior advisor to Senator Joe Lieberman for the past 10 years, worked on his Senate, vice presidential, and presidential campaigns. Dan Gerstein, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Dan, first to you, if I may, what do you think of putting Howard Dean at the helm of the Democratic National Committee?
Well, I'm going to preface my assessment by saying that I am an admirer of Howard Dean in many ways. I think what he did in the primaries was remarkable, the way he energized a lot of people who had been dissatisfied and disgruntled with the political process to engage, I think, was great. I think he has something really important to contribute to the future of the Democratic Party. I just think he's the wrong guy to be leading the party at this moment.
Why?
And here's why. We've lost two national elections in 2002 and then 2004 when we should have won. And one of the primary reasons we lost is because many people in swing districts and red states, wherever you want to say where we're not competing, don't trust us to keep them safe, and they don't believe we share their values. We're not going to get them to listen to us on a range of issues, on the economy, on jobs, and healthcare, education, all these things that Democrats believe in, equal opportunity, until we deal with that credibility problem. Howard Dean, because of his record and because of the perceptions from his failed presidential campaign, just is not capable of dealing with those problems. And what he's been saying and doing since he started running for DNC chair, to me, just confirms he doesn't have an idea how to fix the problem or even that this problem is that big, let alone a strategy.
So him being named chair, a minor problem or a huge problem for the Democrats?
I think it's a problem, but I think it's actually symptomatic of a much bigger problem. There's a huge leadership vacuum in the party, and I honestly believe we haven't seen the worst of the times yet. Until that's going to get fixed.
That is a long way from an endorsement. Katrina VandenHeuvel, how about your view? Howard Dean, he's at the top of the national committee there now for the Democrats. Good thing or not?
I think it's good. Can't disagree with the facts about losing two national elections. Can disagree about why that is. I think one of the reasons is that a lot of Americans don't see in the Democrats a clarity of conviction, a strength of direction. I think the inside the Beltway conventional wisdom is based on dubious facts and assumptions about how ordinary Americans relate to politics. And I think Dean is exactly the leader Democrats need to become relevant again. I think he comes with the endorsements, by the way, of the state chairman from Mississippi and Oklahoma, the vice chairman from Utah. And he also comes with a sense that in this country today, we need to stop maybe casting the questions in terms of right versus left, but the better way might be outside versus inside. So I think Howard Dean brings a lot of enthusiasm. He brings a sense, as you said earlier, about where the Democrats are in relationship to where the Republicans were 30, 40 years ago. He understands that this is going to require coordination, organization, and building and infrastructure to drive the Democrats and their ideals back into the political debate and electoral arena in real ways. He has an understanding also about talking about power and inviting people to think about how they can be reengaged in politics today and an antidote to the cynicism we've seen in our political life. I think that's very powerful.
What about the security issue and the values issue Dan Gerstein raises? And of course, he's not the first. How does Howard Dean play on that front? Can he deliver?
I think, listen, nowadays a majority of the American public believe that attacking Iraq was a bad idea. Dean was saying this and being criticized for it in the fall of 2003. He understands that America needs a strong defense policy, strong national security policy, but not in terms of going to war against Iraq. We took our eyes off the ball. He speaks to that effectively. He also understands, and as the governor of a rural state, let's not forget that, that if you speak with conviction, which I think, with all due respect for a decent man, John Kerry, was sometimes difficult for him, largely because the Republicans demonized it, he walked into that trap. But Howard Dean speaks to rural Americans who are more, you know, more concerned than urban voters about access to health care, education, job loss. And the demographic in this country speaks to more tolerance as we move ahead. And the youth vote, which is crucial to the Democratic Party, and the enthusiasm Dean has mobilized among young people, is the future of this country.
He's certainly a potent speaker. We'll talk about exactly what that solves and what it doesn't. Here's Howard Dean again from Saturday, wrapping up his first address as chairman of the DNC with a call to revitalize the roots of the Democratic Party.
All the ideas in the world won't matter if people don't see our ideas as relevant to them or the political process as connected to them. So we're going to recognize that our strength does reside in the communities. If we're going to take our country back for everyday working Americans, Democrats will have to match or exceed Republican ability to motivate voters. Now, you may find this hard to believe, but I am not much of a Zen person. I have found, however, that the path to power is to trust others with it. We can empower people at the local level, give them the authority to make decisions and to do the right thing. Trust them. If you trust voters, they will trust us. And the Republicans will never, ever be able to do that.
Dan Gerstein, there's Howard Dean over the weekend. Everybody seems to agree this guy can be a very punchy, provoking speaker, one who can rally a lot of people. He did that before. You said earlier that the ability to motivate, he refers to it there, that that's not enough, that there are deep questions unresolved in the Democratic Party that his ascent doesn't solve. Like what?
Oh, well, like national security. Most Americans, the majority of Americans don't believe Democrats have what it takes to keep them safe. We are in the same hole we were in throughout much of the Cold War. We're on national security. Until we climb out of that hole, then all those rural voters that Katrina talked about, and I totally agree with her assessment in that those people should be voting with Democrats because Democrats are more aligned with their interests on domestic issues. But when it comes to values and security in particular, they're not going to listen to anything we say if they don't believe we share their values, that we respect their beliefs, and that we are absolutely committed to prosecuting the war on terrorism. Now, there's a way to do that while expressing reservations with or even outright opposition to the president's policies on Iraq. However, what Howard Dean did, and which many Democrats did throughout the last campaign, was to conflate their opposition to the war in Iraq with their opposition to using force generally. And it made the Democratic Party look like it was dovish, peacenik, and we're back in the 60s fighting those perceptions all over again. We just can't afford to have that perception stay in the party. We've got to have a strategy to show people that we understand the war on terrorism and we can prosecute it better than any Republican can. And again, I don't see Howard Dean or, as a matter of fact, the rest of the leadership of the Democratic Party getting that fact and taking active steps to develop a very real, tangible, communicable national security strategy.
Let's hear from our listeners on that and a lot of points that have been raised here. Steve's calling from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks, Tom.
Sure.
I'm a real believer in Howard Dean. I worked feverishly on his campaign in Wisconsin in the primary. I think on any number of occasions, he spoke raw truth. You'll recall when Saddam Hussein was captured, he said, "It's great we got him. By the way, we're no safer." You'll recall he said, "Southerners with gun racks and Confederate flags might do better voting Democratic than Republican." And for those kinds of things, he was really impaled. But what I can't square that with is if you look at the most recent presidential election, Karl Rove can concoct any 30-second spot and eviscerate any truth-telling, intelligent, you know, honest guy.
So what do you take away from that, Steve? Is raw truth-telling the hallmark the Democrats need, or is it the ability to communicate to win votes?
I'm afraid I don't have a good answer for you, Tom. The guest from the Lieberman campaign mentioned the deficit on national security. And if you look at the polls before the Iraq War, I think most Americans were in favor of using nuclear weapons against Iraqi people. And I canvassed for America Coming Together, talked to 6,000 people in northeast Wisconsin.
Yeah.
I had two people raise as a primary concern civilian casualties in Iraq. So I think there's a great bloodlust in this country and a great tolerance for lies coming from a president. So I'm ready to sign on. But I'm not very hopeful about the American electorate.
But we hear you standing up for Howard Dean, the truth teller. Thanks very much for your call, Steve. I want to hear from one of the state-level officials who was very supportive of Howard Dean. We're joined now from Jackson, Mississippi, by Wayne Dowdy. He is chairman of the Mississippi Democratic Party. He was an early backer of Howard Dean to head the DNC. Wayne Dowdy, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me to be here.
We are hearing tonight that Howard Dean can sure talk up a storm and get people excited, get Democrats excited. But can he win is the question, particularly in the South. You're there. What do you say?
Oh, I think he can. We can certainly be much more competitive in the South, and I think that is the is what Governor Dean will do, make us more competitive.
And what will it be? How will Howard Dean do that?
Well, the same thing he did in his presidential election. Number one, he reaches out to new people. He will bring young people into the Democratic Party. That is the future of the Democratic Party in the South, independents. And number two, he has shown he is, like Terry McAuliffe, an excellent fundraiser, and we've got to be competitive with the Republicans and that continue to be a competitive with the Republicans as a fundraising party.
And what about on the national security front and the so-called values front? Howard Dean, very determinedly secular in the way he talks about things and was against the war in Iraq. Does that tar him in the South, those two things?
In the long run, I think that will be a plus. In the short term, not as great a plus. I think as time goes on in Iraq, his position will be a better one in the South.
So what do we say in the long run? Are we talking about a Barry Goldwater horizon here, the 40-year horizon?
No, in months. We have large numbers of National Guardsmen and reservists from the South who have been called up. in the Bush administration over the last several months. Initially, in the presidential election in the South, there was a lot of clamor, support these local guys who were over there. As more of them become casualties, as people realize what our country has is taking on in Iraq, I think Governor Dean's position will prevail.
Wayne Dowdy in Jackson, Mississippi, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Wayne Dowdy, chairman of the Mississippi Democratic Party. Jack Beatty, you've been listening patiently there, and what an interesting mural this is. We'll hear from a caller who loves Howard Dean, the raw truth teller. Wayne Dowdy in the South saying as the war goes badly, Howard Dean's initial position may gain strength. And yet you have seen right across the kind of moderate wing, and we're hearing it from Dan Gerstein tonight, the wailing from Democrats saying we can't win the middle with this guy.
Yes, and you know, one of the things that Wayne just said I think needs to be examined. He brings new people, he brings young people. Well, you know, he didn't do that in Iowa. Everything was pivoted on Iowa. I don't believe he carried, in fact, I know he didn't carry young people. I don't believe he carried, is it Ames where the university
is? Yes, it
is. I don't believe he carried Ames. You know, there's a lot of talk about this internet explosion that he had, but when it really came down to it, to getting votes, they just weren't there for him in Iowa. Now, there were reasons for it, but he did not draw young people and new people. They went for Kerry. I watched so there's a lot of talk about this, and he did have this stuff on the web, but so far as I understand, that was from his campaign man, Joe Trippi, who had this vision of the web as a way to propagate Democrats and find new money and so on. So I think we've got to be skeptical about this idea that he's got some sort of strong appeal to new voters and young voters, just based on the record.
Saying, where was the beef? Katrina Vandenhoven.
Well, I was going to say, Jack, I mean, there's a difference. I mean, in a way, Howard Dean was not right. He wasn't ready for prime time in 2004, and he wasn't right for the moment. And Iowa became a smoke-filled state. The electability factor was running deep and strong inside the Democratic Party, which moved so many to support John Kerry. This is a different moment. He is not a candidate. He is running the Democratic National Committee. I know you know that. But there's a sense now of the party needing to revive not only its organization, going into states, building a farm team to compete, but there's also a sense that you need the enthusiasm and you need the energy and you do need the internet. The Republicans have outgunned the Democrats in that sphere. And for example, the party needs to revive its state organizations because as we saw in 2004 with unions, with labor, sadly, as weak as they are, Republicans have relied on these kind of rooted local, you know, local communities, whether it's churches or small business groups or gun clubs.
And they've won with that.
The Democrats need to rebuild those rebuild those kinds of groups. I don't know what they will be, but they will be rooted in the community because one thing we saw coming out of 2004 was you can't send people into communities. You need the neighbor to neighbor. Anyway, I think Dean is well suited to that as someone who's run a precinct in Vermont, who's run the Democratic Governors Association. I'm just talking about the infrastructure of it. On the foreign policy national security side, I think it was Jack who wrote a terrific column in the Atlantic Monthly a few months ago. Iraq in the war against terror was an act of self-sabotage. That made the America and the world less secure. We see every day Iran, North Korea. We need a different kind of approach to these security threats. Hyper-militarization does very little. And Dean, I have to say, was very powerful if he can communicate that in a world where AIDS, where global inequality, global instability, those issues are not going to be met with a hyper-militarized approach. We need to reframe the security threat, reframe what security means, and he may well be equipped to do that.
And do you think Americans are prepared to go with that reframing, Katrina Vandenhoven?
I think more and more. Listen, your guest before, blood is running deep in the South. It's running deep in this country. This administration has...
In the Guard and the Reserves and the military members.
Absolutely. And this government has overreached in a way that I think millions of Americans are beginning to see more clearly. So I do think it's a moment where we can say to Americans, of course, the Democrats are strong on security issues. The Republicans have overreached, made us less secure. Let us work together to rebuild a new security policy.
And you would like to see Howard Dean doing it. We've got to take a short break here. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight with Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation magazine. Dan Gerstein, a Democratic communications strategist, worked a lot with Joe Lieberman. Our own Jack Beattie is here. You can join us as well. Can Blue State Dr. Dean reach out to Red State America for the Democrats? And what do the Democrats have to do to win? Can Dean help them do it? What is the central debate, or what should it be, in the Democratic Party right now? Is Howard Dean the answer? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point.
This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the return of Howard Dean as chair of the Democratic National Committee and what it means for the Democratic Party. Could Dean be the Democrats' Goldwater, a loser in his presidential bid, but a winner in carving out his party's future? Or is this another cul-de-sac for the Democrats? 1-800-423-8255. We're joined right now from New York by Bob Carey, president of the New School University there, former Democratic senator and governor of Nebraska. Bob Carey, thank you for being with us tonight.
You're welcome, Tom.
So,
nice to be with him.
It's great to have you. Howard Dean, he's got the helm of the DNC, good or bad?
Indeed.
What do you make
of
it?
Well, he's very smart. He's very talented, and he excites people, and he worked very hard to get this chairmanship, and, you know, I wish him well. I think he's going to, you know, God knows he's got the talent to do an exceptionally good job as chairman, and, you know, the fact that anybody would want to be chairman of either one of these two parties is a real tribute to the fact that Americans have not given up on the political process. So, look, the Democratic Party is much harder to unite than the Republican Party, and I think Howard understands that. He's campaigned for president, and he knows how difficult it is in a primary season, so I think he doesn't need any advice from me or anybody else who's sitting on the sidelines right now. He's full of energy and full of enthusiasm, and I think he's going to do a good job.
So you're a good sport. You're seeing all the supportive things there on a blank slate. Is he the guy you'd put in the middle?
Well, that's not how it works. I mean, the fact is that you've got to put yourself as a candidate, and part of the test of whether or not you can be chairman or chairperson is whether or not you can win. And Howard demonstrated that he can, appeal in spite of the fact that he had lots of negatives. He didn't just lose in the primary. He said some things, he did some things that caused an awful lot of people to say his political career is over. But among the more impressive things that Governor Dean did after he lost the primary is he immediately turned his energy into helping his opponent, John Kerry, with great enthusiasm, unselfishly getting out there working for John. So that's a difficult thing to do. I've been in that position before, and I've watched others in that position. It's a lot easier to say we need to be unified than to get over the, you know, things you say about one another during a campaign. So he
dove in, he put the shoe leather down, he won the DNC chair.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm reading Ryan Lizzie here saying that he did that on the backs of the insular liberal blogosphere, his friends on the web that went to work for him, that kind of hacked down his opponents and built him up. Is that victory the same as the right profile for national support needed to bring the party up?
First of all, I think it underestimates what Howard Dean and the others had to do. They had to go state by state and meet with people and talk to them. You're not going to win, become chairman of the Democratic National Committee as a consequence of having an effective blog and an effective internet strategy. Certainly, you know, blogs and the internet strategy help both offensively and defensively. And God knows there were people who feel like that's exactly what Howard did, but he had to go out there and talk to people and get the confidence of state party organizations where the party is. The party doesn't live any place other than at the state level. It's a combination of 50 individual state parties that puts together a national platform. And again, I mean, Howard understands that. He campaigned nationwide, and he campaigned again for chairman. And I'm not just saying this stuff. I'm very impressed by him. I had some reservations about him. I think there's a lot that he's still got to overcome. But he's demonstrated to me he's got the juice to get it done.
He's got the juice, says Bob Carey, former senator. Bob Carey, thanks so much for giving us your view tonight.
You're welcome.
Great to have you. Bob Carey, now president of the New School University, was senator and governor of Nebraska. I want to get to our callers. So many want to join us. Anita's calling from Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, Anita. You're on the air.
Hi. This is a very exciting and encouraging conversation.
I'm a Democrat and worked in the last campaign here in Northern Illinois.
Okay.
And in our little section of Illinois, it happens to be the Republican headquarters of Illinois, just so you know that.
Right.
And but what I've seen is a real desperation here. And I wonder sometimes at the naivete of the Democratic Party. You know, when I have read and seen and heard all of the dirt that has gone down in the Republican Party, and yet people are oblivious to it, and they voted it in anyway.
So what does it have to do with Howard Dean? How do you connect the dots there, Anita?
The connecting the dots is this. If the Democratic Party or Howard Dean thinks for one moment that if they don't restructure and remarket themselves to the public, take a note from the cowpoke from Texas, frat boy, who marketed himself and was regroomed to be marketable,
mm-hmm.
and as did Karl Rove regroom the entire structure of the Republican Party.
Yeah, but, Anita, I have to ask you, what about Howard Dean? He rolls his sleeves up. He gets those forearms out there. He even yells. Is that not as good as George W. Bush's cowboy boots?
I think it needs to be twofold. One, Howard Dean needs somebody to take him in hand and say, listen, you have great ideas. You can get people excited, but you're preaching to the choir. If you want to get the votes that we don't have already, then you need to tone down the implied arrogance and elitism and Ivy League-ish-ism that those people that you want the votes from see.
They see it, and that's not where they're from. Anita, we've got it, and we thank you very much for your call and your thoughts. Let's get another call right here from New York City. Josh is calling. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was actually a really strong supporter of John Kerry and canvassed against Howard Dean in the primaries up in New Hampshire, and I'm thrilled with this choice of Howard Dean.
Why? Why?
Because I think people are conflating his faults as a presidential candidate with his job as chairman, and the stuff about his past background, about his personal views on individual issues, those things aren't so important. What's important is the ability to reorganize a party and the ability to bring something new in a way of a political structure and getting people excited and bringing new people into the party.
So he's good with the megaphone. He's good at organizing. Josh, our time is short, but thank you. Dan Gerstein, how about it? There we have a voice from outside Chicago saying he's too Ivy League, a voice from New York saying he's not a presidential candidate. He's an organizer now, and he'll be great at that.
Well, I would encourage Josh, the caller, to read a piece that Jonathan Chait wrote in the L.A. Times about the myth of Howard Dean's ability to be a great organizer and an infrastructure builder. You know, his presidential campaign was mismanaged pretty much into the ground. And that's, you know, a lot of people believe that was one of the reasons why he was not successful was that it was complete chaos over there. But I want to get back to a larger point picking up where Katrina left off. The Democratic Party is deluding itself as if we can organize our way out of this problem. We tried to have a base election and run against the Republicans in 2004, and what we found out was their base is bigger than ours. If you do the simple math, we can't win elections unless we draw voters from their side to ours. Now, that in no way means becoming Republican or Republican light. I hate that ridiculous myth. What it does mean, though, is learning what our weaknesses are and why people aren't paying attention to us and why they're not listening to us and why they're not supporting us.
If you're right, why didn't Joe Lieberman do better?
Well, I'll answer that question in a second. But the larger point is we have much bigger problems than Howard Dean can solve or any one single leader can solve. But we need leadership to solve it. We need a realization that our party is bankrupt with ideas. It's not just a question of marketing, as the other caller suggested. The Republican Party right now is the party of big, radical ideas. Most of those ideas are wrong and dangerous for the country, but they're putting ideas on the table. Democrats right now are the party of no. We keep saying we keep defining ourselves in opposition to George Bush. Now, he's done a lot of bad things. He has a lot of bad ideas, but that's not enough to win the public's confidence. We've got to show that we can govern better.
And this, from a Democrat, our time is short. I want to get Katrina's response to that.
Dan,
Katrina.
I mean, I think you talk about mismanaging a campaign. We now have an administration which has mismanaged this country into the ground. I think sometimes it's important to remember that parties are often defined by what they are, what they are for, by being highly principled about what they are against. There are good ideas in the Democratic Party. Howard Dean needs to be a referee. But the idea that this party is in crisis, I think, is overstating. 60,000 votes might have changed in November, we would be in a different shape. I think Howard Dean has a sense of the importance of building again at the state level in 2006, 36 governor's races. Building at the state level is going to be crucial. And I think that another important thing, we can come back again, the issue of conviction of who we are, what we stand for, with clarity. John Kerry didn't do that, and a lot of people are confused by people like Joe Lieberman, who they do think are Republican light.
So let Howard Dean have a chance at it. Jack Meade, I want to get one more remark from you here. We've just got half a minute left. We've got juice on the table, ideas or a lack of them. Howard Dean is a powerhouse or a referee. Will it work, Jack?
Well, he says, my political career is about change, and that's what the Democrats need, but whether he's the doctor for that problem. Myself, and this is just shows how narrow I am, I want to go back to the smoke-filled rooms. I mean, they gave us Harry Truman and FDR, and that was pretty good. And in a chairman, I'd prefer anonymous competence, but we have a leader. He's going to speak out, and he obviously knows how to get into the press. Let's just hope he gets into the press for saying things that people can consent to, and rather than right. things that are controversial.
Well, he's never going to be anonymous. Jack Meade, great to have you with us. Dan Gerstein, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation magazine, thank you very much for being with us. In a moment, celebrating 62 years of Valentine's with Dorothy and Lloyd Bridges. This is On Point. Dorothy Bridges fell in love with actor Lloyd Bridges on the way home from a fraternity dance with their first kiss in the rumble seat of a friend's car. That was the beginning of a lifelong love and 62 years of marriage. They had three children, daughter Lucinda, and sons, actors Beau and Jeff Bridges. Every year on Valentine's Day, Dorothy wrote her husband a love poem. Lloyd Bridges died 7 years ago. Now, at 89, Dorothy has published her poems in a short book, You Caught Me Kissing, a love story by Dorothy Bridges. In this radio diary, she talks about the many Valentines she shared with her husband.
I was a freshman at UCLA. They had what they call presentations. They had all the young girls from the different sororities be at their sorority as sort of a tea and stand in a reception line. And all the young men, or wolves, that we called them at the time, would go up and down sorority row looking at the new crop of girls that had arrived. And the president of the sorority said to me, when Lloyd Bridges comes through, I'm going to give you a nudge, because he's president of the Dramatic Society. And since you wrote some of the plays at your high school, it'd be good if you got in the Dramatic Society. So he came in, she nudged me, we danced, I got in the Dramatic Society, and in the first play, actually, of the season, and it was a small part, he was the leading man. I didn't know or dream that he would become the leading man in my life for 62 years. That's how I met him.
Someday he'll come along, the man I love, and he'll be big and strong, the man I love. And when he comes my way, I'll do my best to make him stay.
You know, no love affair is perfect. And in the course of our marriage, I was very angry with him sometime. But I never, ever let being angry or ready to throw him in the river discourage me from writing him a Valentine just the same. So this is one of the Valentines I wrote when all was not well. We are not always lovers, and if the truth we should tell, sometimes I send you poison darts, and you have made me mad as hell. So long have we known each other that faults are clear to see. I've had to give up changing you, and for sure, you are stuck with me. The leftover dirt from the bad days is swept clear under the rug. Forgiveness is what's between us now, and a heavy duty hug. Champagne of youth was heady. Today, we're sipping still wine. But damn it all, there still lives love. And won't you be my Valentine?
No one to talk with all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. A misbehaving, saving my love for you, for you, for you, for you.
I started writing Valentine's the first year I met him, because I got a mysterious Valentine that was unsigned and said, "How's about it, Valentine?" I thought that was very sort of nervy of someone to write to me. I didn't know who it was, but I had a hint it might have been him. So I started by writing a Valentine to him then, and for the rest of my life, practically, I wrote him a Valentine every year. Even after he died, I wrote him a Valentine, although I didn't know where to send it.
No place to go. I'm home about it, just me and my radio. A misbehaving, saving all my love for you.
This is a poem I wrote on our 50th anniversary. Does love mean less when lovers have grown old? Why can't the flowers bloom right through the snow? Does lack of passion mean hearts grew cold? Are memories the only warmth we know? The touches lose their urgency, it seems, and kisses lack that old seductive fire. Is practicality a trade for dreams and reason now that trait we most admire? There should be mystic ways that couples find to nourish love, the rarest gift of life. Was it the joy and lightness left behind as we matured into a man and wife? Let's look into soul's mirror, love, and see the good, the beauty that we have today. It isn't youth alone that makes love be. Let time go shake the darling buds of May. When I see you, I take it for love's sign. In spring or winter, you're my Valentine.
Every kiss, every hug seems to act just like a drug. You're getting to be a habit with me. Let me stay in your arms. I'm addicted to your charms. You're getting to be a habit with me.
Dorothy Bridges, 89, reading from You Caught Me Kissing, a love story by Dorothy Bridges. She lives in Beverly Hills, California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I couldn't do without my supply. I need you for my own. Oh, I can't break away. I must have you every day. As regularly as coffee or tea. You've got me in your clutches and I can't get free. You're getting to be a habit with me. Can't break.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio. Support for On Point comes from the